Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 17th of February. Abraham Lincoln, Senator George McGovern has said, was our greatest president and a keen student of political expression. Though his personal hero was George Washington, he also had a high regard for Thomas Jefferson. I never had a feeling politically that did not spring from the sentiments embodied in the Declaration of Independence, Lincoln said at a speech in Philadelphia in 1861. Senator George McGovern has written a wonderful book on Abraham Lincoln, and we are going to be talking about Abraham Lincoln this hour of the program. Senator McGovern, of course, representing South Dakota in the U.S. Senate from 1963 to 1981. He was the Democratic nominee for president in 1972, a decorated bomber pilot in World War II, and then he earned his Ph.D. in American History and Government. He's a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom and the World Food Prize, and lives in South Dakota. And we're welcoming phone calls for Senator McGovern this hour. Every time we have him on, our phones just light up. So feel free to get in line good and early. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. And this book is titled Abraham Lincoln. It's part of the American President series by Time Books. So it's a biography of Abraham Lincoln. Senator McGovern, a real pleasure to have you on the air. Hello.
It's always a pleasure to be on your program.
Thank you, Senator McGovern. You know, I remember, I think it was the last time you were here, or maybe you were here one time after that. You, your daughter was in the studio with you, and you really had a hunger for a chocolate milkshake. And every time I think of you, I think of chocolate milkshakes now, and they sound so good, I may have to have one today.
I still love those things, but they're probably not too good for your girth.
That's okay. They give you energy. So, Abraham, I love the book. I just love Abraham Lincoln as well, as this audience knows. Considered not only by you, but in the recent voting by presidential historians, the greatest president we ever had.
Well, I think that's right. He accomplished two major objectives. He kept the Union together while the Southern states were seceding from the Union. I think that was Lincoln's number one objective, was to stop the breakup of the United States. And he succeeded in doing that, and he did it in a way that I think did credit to him as a human being and as the president of the country. The second thing he did was to set in motion steps that led to the emancipation of the slaves. The Emancipation Proclamation that he issued about midpoint in the Civil War freed the slaves in the South, and then other steps were taken, including the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which led to the freeing of all of the slaves. And Lincoln, more than anyone else, deserves credit for that.
And it was the big thing he himself identified as the big thing he did in his life, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He thought the Emancipation Proclamation was the most important single document in his 4 years as President of the United States. It's interesting, though, that there were some other important things that happened during his one term as president that we don't get much attention to. The Homestead Act was passed, and he signed it into law in 1862, and that became the charter of American agriculture, the so-called family farm system. It granted 160 acres to anyone who was willing to live on that size farm for 5 years. At the end of that five-year period, if they had been working that farm, it became theirs. That was a tremendously important action. It happened right in the middle of the war. There was also the establishment of the land-grant colleges. Every state now has a institution with federal help that provides, especially for agriculture and mechanic arts, but generally all around liberal arts education. And thirdly, they established the Department of Agriculture in the middle of the war. So those are three big strides that certainly were very important, especially to states like Wisconsin.
Right. And because of the overwhelming nature of the war and the slave issue, we don't think about that very much. We don't talk about that very much when we think about Lincoln.
Well, that's true. You know, let me mention one other thing.
Sure.
The Transcontinental Railway mm-hmm. was built during the Civil War. The line had already extended from the East Coast out to Omaha, and it was finished under Lincoln's administration all the way to Sacramento. They drove the Golden Spike that joined the lines together out in Utah. But that's a tremendously important development. Lincoln had a great interest in railroads. And a matter of fact, he became one of the leading lawyers for the railways before he became president. So those are important steps that were taken that, as you said, were overshadowed by the Civil War, but nonetheless were very important actions.
Right. I'm sure our family was not alone, but we read the second inaugural address and several of Lincoln's speeches out loud. I love to read them out loud at the dining room table on his 200th birthday, and had a little cake as well. But you talk about him, and these are high words from you, being the most masterful speechwriter in history.
Oh, I think that's true. He certainly was the best of all the American presidents. Now, not in delivery of speeches. He wasn't particularly skillful in the delivery of speeches. It was the composition of the speech where his high intelligence and sometimes real spiritual insights took over. He didn't have a particularly pleasant speaking voice. It was rather high and thin, but he would work on those speeches sometimes for weeks before a single speech. The system that he used was to read for quite a while on the subject he wanted to write about, and sometimes he would read other eloquent speeches, what they had written, and he picked up phrases here and there from people like Daniel Webster and Henry Clay, who were two of his speech models. Then he would do some research to make sure he had all his facts right. Then he would sit down and begin laboriously to write a speech just as eloquent as he could possibly make it. When he had the first draft done, he would have one of his associates, maybe the Secretary of State or the Secretary of War or whoever he thought appropriate, read the speech aloud in his presence so he could hear how it sounded as well as how it looked on paper. Then he would read it aloud to the person he brought in as a critic. To see what that person thought about the sound. And it was while he was doing that in one of his inaugural addresses that, and it was the Secretary of State who was listening, Seward, and he suggested a phrase to Lincoln that I've always thought was one of the best phrases in his speeches, where he refers to the American people and then appeals to what he calls the better angels of our nature.
Yes.
The better angels of our nature. I wish I'd have thought of that.
There's still time. You can think of something just as great, right?
But anyway,
it is a beautiful phrase.
Actually Seward's line. He mm-hmm. suggested taking out a more pedestrian line and substituting this one. So he sometimes picked up ideas from other people.
Let's talk a little bit about his depression, which was very deep. His melancholy was very real, and probably he came close to doing away with his life at some point. which is horrible to imagine, and not having a chance to achieve his greatness. How did his melancholy and depression, do you think, make him perhaps more attuned to human suffering, may have achieved in some unusual way, helped him achieve his greatness?
Well, he had what today we would call clinical depression. Now, that's just a breakdown of your emotional structure. It can be a paralyzing experience. Some people just want to go to bed and pull the sheets over their face. It's really a painful, demoralizing experience. You lose your appetite. You lose your interest in whatever it is you're doing. You don't have any enthusiasm. You're just down and out. Now, today, that's treated by drugs. Paxil, Prozac, lithium, sometimes electric shock therapy, although that's not used as widely now as it was a few years ago. But none of those things were available to Lincoln. And one of the reasons I admire him as highly as I do is that he had to just live with that depression and yet carry on. Right. And he did it. He had the strength of character and the force of the personality and control that while he felt miserable, he still kept up his professional life. And some historians have thought that that did two things. Number one, it strengthened his resolve to control his emotions and still use his energy and his life for constructive purposes. And secondly, as you suggested in your question, it made him more compassionate and sympathetic to other people's problems, whatever they were, maybe poverty, maybe some other kind of illness. He lost two of his sons to illness, and yet he carried on. Mm-hmm. So I think those were a real series of tests of his character and strength.
You spend quite a bit of time in the book on his early years. One of the things that has always struck me about him, and you as well, Senator McGovern, is that he was in school for about a year. He was so brilliant. People knew he was brilliant, but he read. He was a self-educated, brilliant man, and the kind of discipline that took, I find extraordinary.
Well, it is extraordinary. If there was ever such a thing as a self-made man, and there are all kinds of quips about he was a self-made man and he did a terrible job of making, not referring to Lincoln, but some of the other people we know who claim to be self-made. But in Lincoln's case, he had about a year of formal schooling, and it was during that time that he learned to read and he learned to write. And from that point on, he kept reading, writing. He loved to read. He loved to write. And that was a real source of his greatness. His father, with whom Lincoln didn't get along very well, thought he was lazy because when he was trying to get Lincoln working on the farm, he'd frequently find him sitting with his back against a tree reading a book. And to him, his father, that was a sign of laziness. You had to tote that bar, carry that bale, and all these other things. Lincoln didn't particularly enjoy working on the farm. He did it as a young man, but he was not what one would call a born farmer. He rather would work with his mind Not that farmers don't have to do a lot of mind work, too. It's not easy to run a farm. But he was interested in the world of ideas, of principles, of governing, the science of all of those things. And he read everything that he could get his hands on all of his life, never quit reading. And that was the source of his wisdom and his education. Some historians believe that the greatest influence on Lincoln in that direction were his mother and his stepmother. They were both excellent parents. His mother died quite young, but his stepmother was equally impressed with Lincoln. She said he was the finest boy she'd ever encountered.
Oh, isn't that
and,
nice?
She admired his reading, and she encouraged that. She would tell him repeatedly that his future depended on his mind and on his thinking and on his ability to analyze problems and then come up with common sense solutions.
She was right. Listen to your moms. Listen to your stepmoms, right? There's wisdom in that. We're going to take phone calls in a moment. I was so struck, Senator McGovern. I've been to Springfield several times, and we're trying to think about putting together a tour to Springfield. But the moment when President Barack Obama was speaking in Springfield at the celebration, the dinner of Lincoln's 200th birthday, just kind of took my breath away, I must say. There was so much there. There was so much in that appearance. It was a lovely speech, I thought. Could you comment on that?
Well, you know, I'm sure that Barack Obama's role model, according to him, is Abraham Lincoln. He couldn't have picked a better role model, not just because they both spent a lot of time in Springfield, Illinois. They were both members of the Illinois legislature. In Lincoln's case, he went to the House of Representatives for one term, but his opposition to the war with Mexico, which he felt was a mistake, probably meant that he his congressional service would be ended, and it was. Beyond that, I think Barack Obama has some of the same careful speech preparation that Lincoln had. He may have even used some of the same methods, but when I listen to Barack Obama, I hear some of the same tones that I pick up reading Abraham Lincoln. I would love to have heard Lincoln deliver the Gettysburg Address. It's no secret that at the time, nobody was particularly impressed with it. It was only 2.5 minutes long, and Edward Everett, who spoke for 2 hours on the same platform that day, was considered the highlight of the day. But I hear some of the same phraseology. I hear some of the same references to the scriptures and things. And I think that Barack Obama comes as close to a modern-day Lincoln as anyone we have.
Senator George McGovern is our guest this hour. He has a new book on Abraham Lincoln that is titled Abraham Lincoln. It has just been published by Times Books. And we're going to take phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Senator George McGovern is our guest. Let's go to an email as long as we're talking about President Obama and Lincoln. This is somebody who was your New York State presidential campaign coordinator, Senator McGovern, and says, Jeff Klenk, that he is happy to hear you on the air. What advice do you think President Lincoln would give President Obama at this point in his presidency?
Well, that's hard to answer. I think he would approve of Barack Obama's effort to make his cabinet a rather broadly based group. He's got three Republicans that he selected for his cabinet. Lincoln would approve that. Of course, Lincoln's the founder of the Republican Party. But what he would approve is the effort by Barack to reach out to some of the people that might otherwise not be brought in to support his program. I can't speak for Lincoln on this score, but I know that he strongly opposed the Mexican War that was ordered by President Polk. I have the feeling that he might urge Barack Obama, don't send the American army into Afghanistan. We've got enough people in there now, and we probably ought to take out the ones that are there. Everybody that's tried to reorganize Afghanistan and get all those warlords that are sitting on mountaintops across that country, they've gotten into trouble. The British first a century ago, then the Russians in the 1980s, just a few years ago. And I don't think we can sort out that problem. I don't think we have any responsibility to do so.
Let's go to Mike. Hi, Mike from Milwaukee. Hello.
Well, hello. In 1857, Chief Justice Taney of the Supreme Court reasoned in handling down the Dred Scott decision that a black person has no rights which a white man need respect. That's a quote. But, and then finally, Abraham Lincoln. It's amazing that our history books never told us. In one of his well-publicized debates with Stephen Douglas, Lincoln stated, and here's the quote, "I am not nor ever been in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races. There must be the position of superior and inferior, and I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race." End of quote.
Not a good statement. I think if Lincoln could have looked at that 25 years later, which he couldn't, of course, he would be embarrassed by it. He later had a much more humane and intelligent view of those questions, and I think he would regret that, as I say, if he'd had a chance to look at it some years.
You write in the book about his thoughts about slavery, that he was always morally opposed to slavery.
He had been slavery since he was a young man. He thought it was immoral, and he couldn't abide it personally. But he felt that the political situation was that if he tried to abolish slavery in one stroke of the pen, that he'd lose half the country. And that's why he never joined any of the abolitionist societies. Now, they obviously had a more defensible position from a moral point of view. And today we'd say the abolitionists were right. But Lincoln felt, as a national leader, that he'd lose his influence over about half the country if he opposed slavery to the point where he just terminated it in one stroke. And that's why he tried to get the South to stay in the Union by telling them that he would free none of the slaves if he could save the Union by doing that. He would free all of the slaves if he could save the Union by doing that. He would free some of the slaves and wholesome if he could save the Union in that fashion, but the Union had to be preserved. So his first order of business was to keep the United States from falling apart. Secondly, he took on the slavery question.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what you have called his first great speech, Senator McGovern, the 1854 Peoria speech that dealt with the Kansas-Nebraska Act.
Well, he was opposed to the Kansas-Nebraska Act. He thought it was, what it did in effect is say that each state should decide whether they were going to be slave or free. He felt that that was a decision that had to apply to all states, that the federal government could determine the outcome of that, and that it should not be left to the individual states. But that speech was put together so eloquently and so logically that it goes down in history as one of five or six great speeches that he made.
Thanks, Mike, very much for the call. Let's go to Daniel from Rice Lake. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. Lincoln must have known many Southerners hated him, if not most. Did Lincoln harbor a death wish? Where was Lincoln's bodyguard that fatal night at Ford's Theater?
Well, that's a good question. There's no doubt that that act prompted much tighter security around the president after that. There should have been better protection for the president. But in those days, people were not as alert as they are today to the kind of danger that a president faces every time he goes out in public. I don't think you can point the finger, though, at any one person after that shooting. It was handled by somebody who had easy access to the theater or and any part of it because he was a well-known actor who had acted in that theater and knew every nook and cranny about it. So I think it's just one of those tragedies that even if he had had bodyguards around him, it might have been comparatively easy to step out of the darkness and put a pistol to the president's head.
Mm-hmm. Well, you look at how open the White House was in those days, Senator McGovern, and he was entertaining visits from citizens from all over asking for this and that, and he patiently listened to all of them. It was pretty wide open, wasn't it?
It was, and as a matter of fact, even well into the 20th century, people could still enter the White House lawns, and sometimes the president would come out and visit with them on the lawn. And there was no really tight security until comparatively late in our history.
Right. Thanks, Dan.
It's probably much tighter today than at any time in the past.
I would imagine. Thanks, Daniel, for the call. Eugene from Viola is next. Hi, Eugene.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to speak to you, Senator McGovern. I have a question and I have a comment, too, if I could, please. I was wondering how the Homestead Act affected South Dakota. That's where I started teaching in 1964. I was on the Yankton Reservation at Greenwood, just below Wagner. And that's Charles Wicks County. It's laid out in the Lazy L. I spent a number of years out there, and I got a lot of good memories of that state and that area.
Mm-hmm. Well, fine. I'm glad to hear that. Well, the Homestead Act, as you know, provided for 160-acre tracts. That's a fourth of a section. Any family that wanted to lay claim to 160 acres of federal public lands was given that 160 acres after they had lived on it and farmed it for 5 years. They didn't immediately get title. They had to work the farm for 5 years, and then it was theirs. But what it did in South Dakota and Wisconsin and Nebraska and other states was set the pattern that existed for many years, that a family farm was roughly 160 acres. Of course, today, farms in most agricultural states are considerably larger than that. But the principle of the family farm was established with that Homestead Act of 1862.
Thank you, Eugene, so much for your call. We go next to Wayne from Green Bay. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning, Kathleen. And Senator McGovern, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm a longtime fan of yours. I really don't have a question other than I look forward to reading your new book on Lincoln. And I want to say, by the way, I'm right now looking at a poster, which is 21 by 20 of side view of you from your 72 presidential bid. I had to dig it out when I just heard you were on the radio. And
thank you so much. Are we going to be able to replace Brett Favre?
He lives right down the street. Well, he lived right down the street from me. There's always somebody to replace, isn't there?
Yes, I should say.
I also want to say you were as right on about Afghanistan as you were about Vietnam. And I hope Obama's listening also, so he figures a way to get out of there.
The problem with going into Afghanistan with the American Army after some 6 years in Iraq is that it's almost a perfect example of going from the frying pan into the fire. We've had a terrible time in Iraq. We never should have sent American forces into that country. And I think we'll have equally bitter results in Afghanistan. What you have there, if I can exaggerate the point a bit, is a warlord sitting on top of almost every mountain, and Afghanistan is mostly mountains, and they're glowering at each other. There's no really effective central government there. You've got these warlords, but the one thing that unites them is for a foreign power to try to occupy the country. Then they all get together, gang up, and you usually come out the loser. The Russians sent 100,000 crack troops in there in the 1980s. They were in there a little over a decade. 25,000 of those troops were killed, and many of the others badly wounded. They finally limped out of there, defeated by these rebellious warlords and everybody else that pitched in to defeat the Russian cause. So I don't see us having any better result, and I just hope that the president won't make that move.
Thanks very much for the call. Is he hearing, I understand during this week that there is some talk about revising the policy that they had of sending in 30,000 more troops. Do you know if he's hearing, his staff is hearing your worries about this?
Well, I wrote a piece for the Sunday Washington Post Outlook section. It's widely read. I'm sure the president has seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've said on numerous public forums over the last year that I hope we do not get a major American force into Afghanistan because I see no good coming from it. We've got that Taliban group in Afghanistan. I wish they weren't around. They're the ones that treat women with scorn. They really just treat them as chattels, and nobody likes that. But I don't think we have either the responsibility or the capacity to make everything right in Afghanistan. I think it'll be resisted across that country, and it'll be a losing effort.
Let's go to Phil from Golden Lake. Hi, Phil.
Yeah, hi. This is a terrific show. I'm in the process of creating a Lincoln website called This Week with Lincoln, and I'm really looking forward to reading the book. Anyway, I'm just wondering what Senator McGovern might say about Lincoln's reluctance and how he actually had to be prodded to rise to the point of a serious candidate. I'm reading a book now about Charles Ray, who I bought the Chicago Tribune in 1855 and seemed to be instrumental in this. And he is quoted in a letter to Lincoln: "It is my suspicion that Abraham Lincoln was not born with the silver spoon in his mouth, and that suspicion more than anything else impels me to make the request I did, which was that he debate Stephen Douglas, which apparently he was reluctant to do. And, of course, that was what, you know, propelled him, thanks to the Telegraph and newspaper accounts all over the country, to national prominence.
Well, that's true. Lincoln didn't push himself ahead to get into combat with anybody. He would rather keep his own counsel. But he saw in the Douglas an opportunity for him to achieve not only fame in Illinois, but also nationally. And that's the way it worked out. It was those Lincoln-Douglas debates where people across the country really began to see that here was a man of great ability. Douglas was no pushover. He was a good debater. He had great experience in political competition. So he was not an easy target. I think it's fair to say that Lincoln won that series of debates, but not overwhelmingly. And it was a good school of hard knocks for him to go through that I think made it possible for him to emerge as the first presidential nominee of his new party, the Republican Party. Lincoln had always been a Whig, but he became dissatisfied with the party, as did some of his other associates, and they formed this new party that was the Republican Party. I don't think that he would have emerged as the nominee for president in 1860 if it had not been for that series of debates in 1858.
More phone calls for Senator George McGovern in just a moment. He has a new book. He's written some 12 other books, if not more than that. This one is Abraham Lincoln, and it is part of the Time biography series of U.S. presidents. Times Books has just released this in honor of Abraham Lincoln's 200th birthday, President of the United States, from 1861 to 1865. More phone calls. Thanks, Phil, for your call. 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@WPR.org. And I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls now for Senator McGovern, and let's go to Mary from Ripon. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
Hi.
How are you this morning?
Fine. How are you?
Good.
Good.
I have a question for Senator McGovern. It's regarding President Lincoln, who was born during the time that President Adams and President Jefferson were still alive. And I know he was a young man, obviously, when they passed away in 1826. And I know he was an avid reader. But I guess I'm curious to know how interested was he in their presidencies, and how much did he read, and how much did it influence his wanting to get into politics?
Well, I'll do the best I can in answering that. We don't know all of the influences that worked on Lincoln, but his hero was George Washington. I think he never varied from that. He thought Washington was a masterful leader and a great man, and many times he cited Washington as his model. In terms of contemporaries, Henry Clay and Daniel Webster were his two heroes. He admired their handling of ideas. He admired their oratorical abilities, and they were very important in his life. Now, interestingly enough, although he said that Washington was his number one hero, he singled out the Declaration of Independence, which was written largely by Thomas Jefferson, as the greatest document in the founding of the nation. He knew it virtually by heart. He frequently cited it. we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Lincoln loved that phrase, and it was never far from his consciousness. As to how much he drew from John Adams, I didn't find evidence that that figured significantly in his own philosophy. But I think Washington, Jefferson, Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, all of those were big figures in his life.
Well, thank you so much for the information. I'm studying, I'm later in life now, I've gotten really interested in early American history and colonial America, and I just found it fascinating that even though as a child he was, you know, grew up in Illinois, so that was obviously much farther west than, you know, the founding fathers. But I just, had been curious as to how he, you know, how much he did study that. And because I know that Jefferson was obviously, people thought him as, you know, a very eloquent writer with words and everything. And so I just found that interesting to see how they would, you know, and since he was alive at that time, I just found that very, very, very fascinating. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate the answer.
Thanks, Mary. Thanks very much for the call. I know that you, and it was probably not my school, but my mother had me memorize the Gettysburg Address, which I can still recite as well. But you talk about your years in the public schools of Mitchell, South Dakota, being required to memorize and recite Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, and it sounds like you also have learned the Declaration of Independence. There is something about memorization, particularly of Lincoln, but others as well, that may serve us well these days to know those things. They're just in our memory as well.
Yes. Well, I've always been glad that I had to memorize the Gettysburg Address. I think I can still recite it to this day. It's probably the most condensed and beautifully written speech of Lincoln's life, lasting only 2.5 minutes. When I get up and speak 10 minutes, I think that's a very brief speech. But Lincoln put into that 2.5-minute speech some of the most moving language in our history, and I think it's quite a remarkable testimony to the skill that he had in composing speeches.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much for the call, Mary. And let's go to Tom from Burlington. Hello, Tom.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to talk to somebody who served in Congress with my father, Charles A. Boyle from Illinois. In 1957, I believe you were in the House of Representatives, and that you put through the first civil rights bill ever enacted since the Civil War. It was almost 100 years since the Civil War. And I wonder that somebody said that a congressman from Arkansas pulled a gun on my father in the cloakroom, where the cloakroom is right back there, you know, where the cloakroom is. And I wonder if you know anything about that and how hard it was to get that bill through.
Okay. Thanks, Tom, for the call.
Well, it was certainly tough to get the bill through. Those were the days of the filibuster. I sat through the passage of the Public Accommodations Act in 1964 and then the Voting Rights Act in 1965, and there were long filibusters on both of those major pieces of legislation. By the way, Lyndon Johnson deserves a lot of the credit for the passage of those two charters of equality and freedom. As for the gun being pulled in the cloakroom, I never saw anything like that. I have seen a few arguments, but I've never seen any fisticuffs, to say nothing of any gun being pulled in any of the cloakroom experience that I observed.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's go next to Bob from Oshkosh. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Senator McGovern.
Hello.
Yes, it's a pleasure talking to you, sir. My question is, if Lincoln hadn't been assassinated, how would that have affected the outcome of the war and the relationship between the races. Thank you. I'll hang up now.
Thank you very much for the call.
I've always thought that if Lincoln had lived to complete his second term that he had been elected to, that Reconstruction would have gone more smoothly. Lincoln was a peacemaker. He was a negotiator. He was a good diplomat. And I think he would have dealt with the South in a way that was more sensitive to the injured feelings that existed across that part of our country after the war. Keep in mind, 600,000 young men were killed in that war. Partly because everybody who died was an American. Unlike other wars in which we had foreign enemies, mm-hmm. this had one group of Americans against another, and over 600,000 of them died, to say nothing of the ones who lost legs or arms or mental balance, other terrible casualties of the war. And I think Lincoln, having lived through that, if he could have completed that second term, the Reconstruction period, and the accommodation of Southern needs would have gone more smoothly.
Tell me, I'm a little envious of being able to spend time writing a book on Abraham Lincoln. I'm wondering, Senator McGovern, how you went about doing this. Who did you read? Did you go to Springfield? Did you hole up in a library somewhere? How did you go about the process?
Well, I was approached by Arthur Schlesinger, who was the general editor of the series. As you've indicated, they're doing a book. Time Books is doing a book that they wanted each person to hold to about 165 or 170 pages. And they have a different author for each president. When Arthur approached me and asked if I wanted to do one of these books, I tried to beg off on it. I was working with Bob Dole on this international school lunch program that he and I are pushing, and I wanted to give a lot of time to that, which I still do. So I kind of begged off on it, and Arthur said, look, you've been telling me for years that Northwestern, where you got your PhD in history, is better than Harvard. Now you've got a chance to prove that. Write the book. Anyway, I said, well, if I could get Abraham Lincoln, I might do it.
Oh.
Too bad, he said. President Clinton has asked for Lincoln. And he said, you may find this a surprise, George, but people who actually got elected president outrank those who just got nominated, which, of course, I knew. So I yielded to Bill Clinton. But I said, if he decides not to do it, give me a ring. A year later, he comes back. Said, guess what? President Clinton's going to have to back out. He says he just can't do this book. So that's how I got into it. What I did was to read many of the best things that have ever been written about Lincoln. I looked at some of his speeches, read many of his speeches. I read some of his letters to people. I talked to others who were experts on Abraham Lincoln, and then I began to write. I knew if I was going to get it done before Lincoln's 200th birthday, which is what they wanted me to do, I'd have to really work at it and burn the midnight oil, and that's what I did. I write everything out in longhand. I suppose I should join the age of science and the technology and start using this modern equipment. But so far, my mind works better when I've got a pen in my hand and writing on a pad of paper. So that's how I put it together.
Yeah, I'm so glad you did. And you must be happy in some sense that President Clinton decided to pass on the project.
Well, in a way, I am. He'd have written a book, I'm sure of that. But I am a trained historian. That's what I was doing before I got into politics. And I think I've done a good job on this book. And even though it stayed within the 165-page guideline, I think I got all the essential information in there.
You did indeed. It was a pleasure to read and always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you, Senator McGovern.
Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. Senator George McGovern, the book is Abraham Lincoln. George McGovern on Abraham Lincoln, and it has been just published by Times Books, their series on the presidents. So that's that hour. Just as good as I thought it was going to be. I'm glad I asked him that last question. I didn't think I was going to, but it was an interesting answer, wasn't it? Okay, that's it for today. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. You know, we've been thinking about, I'm just going to bring this up now to see if there might be interest here, about getting a bus group together of public radio listeners to go to Springfield, Illinois this year and to have a Lincoln Scholar on the bus, and I'd be on the bus, and Rhonda and Rob, maybe John Treader can come too, and we will go to Springfield and maybe on a Friday and come back on Sunday night. Oh, what a trip. I've been there so many times, but I love it. Go to the library, go to the old State House. So if you might be interested in something like that, send me an email, okay, so we can gauge interest. It's dunk@wpr.org, and we'll figure this out. Spring, summer, fall, one of those times. Thanks for listening, everybody, here on the Ideas Network.